Amen. Well, our topic is signs of the end of the age. A friend once asked Isidore I. Rabbi, a Nobel Prize winner in science, how did you become a scientist? And Isidore replied, every day when I arrived home from school, my mother would ask me, not so much what I learned that day, but she always inquired, did you ask a good question today? And Isidore Rabbi said, asking good questions helped me become a scientist. Well, in the passage before us tonight, the disciples in verse 3 ask two very good questions. Questions are a bit like keys, aren't they? They unlock the door of information. They help us to discover more. The context is this. The temple in Jerusalem was once one of the wonders of the world. It was begun by Herod in around 20 BC. It dominated the city of Jerusalem, and its golden walls meant it could be seen for miles around. Much more than that, the temple was the heart of Jewish national, cultural, and religious identity. For them, it also signified and represented the presence of God on earth. In verse 1, the disciples draw the attention of Jesus to the wonder of the building. Look at it, Lord. Wow. Fantastic. And in verse 2, Jesus stuns them with his reply. He says, it might be wonderful, but its days are numbered. Now, don't miss the impact of those words. That which seems to be permanent for you, that which seems to be unmovable, said Jesus, that which is a fixture on the landscape, that which seems so important, even symbolically the place of God on planet Earth, its days are numbered, and it will soon be gone. So the disciples respond to this startling announcement by asking two questions. Verse 4, when will these things happen? And again verse 4, and what will be the sign that they're about to be fulfilled? Now, three things I want us to note by way of introduction into this passage. Number one, the response of Jesus in these first verses is kind of slightly confusing. Because in answering the disciples' questions, the answer Jesus gives is kind of parallel. It has two meanings. It has an immediate meaning for the disciples, the fall and the destruction of Jerusalem, and that happened in around about AD 70, and we'll mention that again a little bit later. But it has a more extensive meaning, the end of the age. And these dual meanings, kind of apply to all that Jesus says. There is an initial fulfillment, and then there is a greater fulfillment. And often prophecies like that, isn't it, if you've studied Old Testament prophecy. So first of all, it might appear slightly confusing. Secondly, remember the context and the culture these verses were written in. Remember the context, the culture these verses were written in. Many of Jesus' hearers would have assumed that if the destruction of the temple took place, then that meant the end of the world. The two rose and fell together. After all, this was their permanent fixture. This was their glorification of God. If that went, why? What else was it to live for? So to the Jewish mind, the temple and the end of the world, if they would happen together, one and the same. But in verse 2, Jesus separates the two events. This permanent building will be gone, and life will go on, and these things will happen. And then the third thing to note as we look at the passage, keep in mind as we read these verses, this is not an all-exclusive teaching on end times, the end of the age. Rather, it is selective teaching. Other New Testament writers will add a whole lot more specific information. They'll tell us about the rapture, the church, the tribulation, the millennium kingdom. All sorts of things will be added. So it's not all exclusive. Read this passage and you know everything that's going to happen. No, no, no. This is selective. Jesus, a Jew, is talking to the disciples who are Jews about a Jewish city. So it's focused teaching. A Jew is telling Jews about a Jewish city and what's going to happen to it. So keep that in mind. So that's by way of introduction. But in the passage, what Jesus shares has that initial impact for the Jews, but it has a wider fulfillment for everyone else. So it's applicable to all of us in some way. And Jesus gives a number of warnings to his disciples. Warning number one, he tells them to look out for false messiahs. False messiahs. Let's read verses 5 to 6 of Mark chapter 13. Jesus said to them, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am he,' and he will deceive many." Watch out for false messiahs. Don't know if you heard the news this week, but apparently they've taken the word gullible out of the dictionary. Now, of course, if you believe that, you're very gullible, aren't you? Christians can be very gullible. And the reason they can be very gullible is often they can be very sincere. And if you're keen to learn the Bible, and you have a desire to learn about God, you kind of leave the back door open for folks who have got a particular bent or a particular error to kind of go through and lead you astray. That's why Jesus says again and again, watch out, watch out. Sincerity is good, but it's not enough. You need to engage brain. That's why God gave you one. And one area where some Christians have been deceived, and Christian history records this again and again and again, is that they tend to follow false messiahs. People who appear and they are good, sound Bible teachers, but they tend to call a group of people who follow them, and then over a period of time they introduce false teaching and reveal themselves as the Messiah. And there are cases of that. It wasn't too long ago there was the situation in America with David Koresh, wasn't there? And all that particular tragedy at Waco. But people arise, good, solid, biblical background, but then they go off the rail and take others with them. So don't be misled, said Jesus. Misleading can happen deliberately. It can happen secretly. I did hear the story of an old sailing ship. And one day the captain caught the shipmates drunk. And despite their pleadings, the captain insisted that the sailors record this incident in the captain's log, the ship's log. Reluctantly, one of the drunken sailors wrote these words, "Seaman Smith was drunk today." Annoyed that the captain had made him do this, he plotted his revenge. And the next day, when the captain looked into the logbook, to his amazement, the same sailor had added a statement about the captain's. And this is what he wrote. "The captain was not drunk today." Now, of course, his implication was every other day he was drunk, but today he kept sober. It was an innocent and it was a true statement, but of course it was very misleading to those who would read the journal later on. And here Jesus says in verse 5 and 6, "Do not be misled by religious leaders who come in my name and they claim I am he, or they claim that the time is near. Do not go after them." In fact, elsewhere in the New Testament, Luke chapter 17, verse 23, he made it quite clear that when the Messiah does return, when Christ does come, it won't be something secretive. It won't be something that draws itself out slowly. It will be dynamic, it'll be instant, it'll be fast. It'll be like a bolt of lightning that lights up the sky. So in other words, he's not returning as a humble carpenter or a secular job of any description. He's coming as a conquering king, like an invading army, when he returns. So if anyone says, "I am the Messiah," ignore them. Secondly, Jesus said, there will be wars. Verse 7. "When you hear of wars and rumours of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom." Now, when Jesus spoke these words, the Roman Empire had enjoyed a very long era of peace. For about 4 decades, no wars. Peace across the Roman Empire. But soon Rome would have 4 different emperors in 1 year. And that political upheaval would cause incredible military strife. And it would greatly affect the world of the early church. And Jesus said that political upheavals and military strife will also mark the end of time as well. According to World Vision on their website, they write these words: global military expenditure is now running well over $1 million per minute. According to New International Magazine, 1 in every 5 scientists worldwide is now engaged in military work. And the average military product is 20 times as research intensive as civilian product. It's nice to live in peaceful times, isn't it? Well, our governments may give us the impression we're living in peace, but actually in practice they are funding, financially and with expertise, war. Jesus said in verse 8, listen, these are the beginnings of birth pains. In other words, don't be panicking. Don't be frightened by the situation you're in. Something better will come out. Just like a lady who has labour pains will eventually produce a child and then forget the pains because of the joy of the child. Short term, these events and signs are sad and part of living in a world gone wrong, a fallen world. Long term, be encouraged. They are stepping stones that lead us on to our final goal. And by means of them, the end of the age is both foreshadowed and brought closer. So said Jesus, false messiahs, don't follow them. Wars and rumours of wars, signposts that things are happening. Thirdly, he said, natural disasters, verse 8. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. And if you go online and you search the web, you'll be amazed how many earthquakes are happening, even this past month, around the world, and how many famines there are across the world. I guess it's notable that these events are expressions of a world that is instable, the instability of the world. And actually, the passage refers to instability in different spheres. The political, the religious, the physical. It's a world in turmoil, a world out of control. And Jesus is reminding his disciples that this instability has to continue until the king returns and sets up his kingdom and brings stability. And when the Lord returns a second time, in the areas of politics and religions and physically, that's when peace will come upon the earth. But until then, this instability are merely signs, stepping stones, leading us on to our final goal. Fourthly, there will be persecution. Look at verse 12. You must be on your guard. You will be handed over to local councils and flogged in the synagogues. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Whenever you are arrested and brought to trial, do not worry beforehand about what to say. Just say whatever is given to you at the time. For it is not you speaking, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will be betrayed brother to death, as a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. In verse 12, Jesus moves from the distant future to the immediate future for the disciples. This is the future you're going to face, Jesus tells the disciples. And actually, this is a summary of the book of Acts, which chronicles the bloody trial of men and women who carried the gospel to the ends of the earth. But that trial, of course, didn't happen in Acts chapter 28. It didn't end It carries on. You and I are Acts chapter 29. And the church continues generation after generation. And the persecution carries on. Have a look at this little DVD clip just for a few minutes. Open Doors produced it, but it just reminds us of the times we're living in.
Each year, Open Doors assembles the world to watch this, to focus the world's attention on places where religious freedom is limited, where persecution occurs. Based on data received from reports around the globe, this list of 50 countries is created to bring attention to the most oppressive places in the world for Christians to live. This gives Christians who are afraid to believe an opportunity to unite in prayer, provide advocacy, give assistance, and encourage suffering believers. Here is a brief overview of 4 countries on this list. In Mexico, converting to Christianity is discouraged, and evangelism is often prohibited. Moroccan authorities are more apt to deport Christians rather than torture or steal them for their religious beliefs. In Pakistan, the expansion of one state is severely limited. Since Islam is recognized as a state religion, blasphemies are used to intimidate and eliminate non-Muslims. Authorities often draw pleas for justice. Other countries where persecution is most severe include Iran. Under the judicial interpretation of Sharia law, any Muslims who convert to Christianity can face a mandatory penalty of death. Existing secret house churches are watched by secret police. Those who attend are often arrested and beaten. North Korea is the most dangerous country in the world for Christians. Here, everyone is required to worship the nation's leader, Kim Jong-il. He and his son, Kim Jong-un, named successor of his father, have targeted Christians as a threat to their country. If believers are discovered in North Korea, they are sent to labor camps and often executed. These countries represent an often ignored truth today. More Christians have been tortured and killed for their faith in the past 100 years than in the previous 200 years combined. Share the truth with others. For more information, please visit Open Doors website.
Persecution. Don't panic, said Jesus. They're stepping stones. They're reminders that we're on the right track and that the Lord is coming fast. That's where I am now. Let's move on to the last one, which is hard to summarise. I've summarised it as the Jewish temple because it's things to relate to the destruction of Jerusalem. Verses 14 to 20. In these verses, Jesus expounds on what he predicted in verses 1 to 2 when he said, no stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. This building you assume was permanent, there forever, every single stone will be toppled. And now he expands on it in these verses. Verse 14. When you see the abomination that causes desolation, standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of this house go down or enter the house or take anything out. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that this will not take place in winter, because those days will be the days of distress, unequalled from the beginning, when God created the world until now, and never to be equalled again. If the Lord had not cut short those days, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, whom he has chosen, he has shortened them. What an expression. The abomination that causes desolation. Actually, it's an Old Testament expression, and three times you'll find it in the book of Daniel. Chapter 9, verse 27, chapter 11, verse 31, chapter 12, verse 11. The abomination that causes desolation. Abomination simply means something that's repulsive. It's repugnant to God. So something's going to happen that is displeasing, that is repugnant, repulsive to God. That's abomination. Desolation means misery, unhappiness, despair. Something that is laid to waste, destroyed. So that expression, the abomination of desolation, means something's going to happen that is repulsive to God, and the end will be waste, desolation, sadness. Well, Jesus said it relates to the temple. And in AD 70, the temple was destroyed by the Roman Emperor Vespasian. The prophecy was initially fulfilled. He sent his son Titus to crush a Jewish rebellion and literally to destroy Jerusalem. He besieged the city for 5 months, beginning in April, when Jerusalem was filled with Passover pilgrims, and he starved the inhabitants out of the city. They even resorted to cannibalism to survive. Eventually, the Roman army breached the walls, slaughtered men, women and children, demolished the city and destroyed the temple. According to the historian Josephus, 1 million Jews perished in that war. 97,000 were taken as slaves. It was a terrible, terrible time. So that was the initial fulfillment. But as often with the Bible, there is a latter fulfillment. And scholars believe the latter fulfillment is what we read about in the book of Revelation, where it talks about a tribulation, a time of suffering, distress, of pain and trouble. And if you're keen, you can read those for yourself, or you can pick up a commentary and that will highlight the passages to look at. And Jesus' response: watch out, don't be deceived. Some folks, of course, are fascinated by Bible prophecy, aren't they? I freely admit I struggle with it. I was told, leave prophecy to older men, because they're not around to see their mistakes. I'm trying to get bogged down with details, just to look at the big outline and give you the skeleton. I guess there are three big principles to note as we finish. Number one, the return of Christ will be unprecedented. Nothing like it will have ever happened before. That's why the writers of the New Testament struggle to find words to explain it. It has no parallel in human history. And Jesus is saying, don't look for other earthly men. I'm not coming back the second time like I came the first time. When I return to set up my kingdom, it will be in an unparalleled way. You can't miss it. Secondly, the return of Christ will be unmistakable. Unmistakable. He will come like lightning and every eye will see him. Thirdly, the return of Christ will be unexpected. It'll be on a day that starts like any other day. And the New Testament uses an interesting illustration, like a thief in the night. Because if you knew the thief was coming, you'd sit up and capture them, wouldn't you? But a thief comes when you least expect it. Jesus did not want his disciples to get so involved in the prophecies of the future that they neglected their responsibilities in the present. And so he finished with a parable of a fig tree. Most trees in Israel were evergreens. They kept their colour all year round. Not so the fig tree. That was different. It changed during the different seasons. It had large leaves in springtime. So if you were to look at it and see shoots on the tree, it was a clear indication that summer was near. So says Jesus, when you see these signs, false messiahs, wars, natural disasters, persecution, the role of Jerusalem and Israel in political upheaval, they're simply signs, not merely of the end of the age, but that the Lord is coming, and when he sets up his kingdom, these things and only then will be put right. Let's pray.